Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. This evening's show is about reworking, retelling and reimagining stories. I'll be talking to Margaret Atwood and Jonathan Coe about fairy tales and utopian classics.
We were using science fiction to talk about McCarthyism.
We'll look at how they've taken well-known tales and modernised them for new generations.
Young readers can handle a lot more than we maybe give them credit for.
Get in touch by email bookshow@rte.ie and find us on Twitter and Facebook at bookshowrte. But first... That's, of course, the Ron Grainer, Delia Derbyshire music for Doctor Who, broadcast for the first time 50 years ago today. Owen Colfer, known for his Artemis Fowl series, and most recently Warp, the Reluctant Assassin, joins me now in studio. Owen, you wrote an e-short story earlier this year, one of 11 stories in a Doctor Who e-shorts anthology, which is published in full online today and on Kindle. Did panic set in when you were first asked to write for the Doctor, or did you have a stash of ideas just in case the day ever came?
No, I was kind of gleeful when this came because I have never, ever seen an episode of Doctor Who. So when this episode, when this invitation came in, I went, I wonder, is it possible to write a story of Doctor Who from casual knowledge? So I saw this as a challenge. Now, I don't want to make it seem like...
How had you managed to miss seeing episodes of Doctor Who?
Well, when I was a kid, we didn't have that channel. We had RT1 and UTV, or HTV, I think it was called, Harlech. Television in black and white, which you switched over by means of a large manual switch, which you had to haul across, which was quite physical. You really had to put your muscles behind it. So we just didn't have BBC. So we had heard of Doctor Who and we longed to see it, but we had no copies of the Radio Times because we didn't need it in our house. And my friends saw Doctor Who, but I never saw it. So my access to Doctor Who was through the books, the adaptations that my cousin Kevin from Liverpool would bring over. So I had read a lot of Doctor Who, but I had never seen it. And when it came around again, I was too old for it. So when Christopher Eccleston made the new series, you know, I'm too old because it's a kid's show now, I think. So, you know, I'm not going to watch it now. Although, granted, when Kylie Minogue was in it, I did have a
little glance. You maybe turned it on for 5 minutes.
For 5 minutes to have a look. But I haven't seen it. So I thought, this is really interesting. I could have a go at writing a story from my memory of reading books in the late 1970s. That would be really fun and interesting. And the only reason I would do anything like this is if it's interesting to me, because I'm in a room on my own all the time and I have to be interested. Otherwise, you go nuts. So I thought I'll do it and see what happens. And I honestly thought there's no way they're going to take my story. And so how I approached it was, I said, I'll do the first Doctor and I'll do before he does anything on TV. So nothing has happened. I can't mess up anything. He can't have affected anyone. I can do whatever I like. So I cut off his hand. I invented new villains. There's nothing really connecting him to the rest of the Doctor canon, except his granddaughter. I only knew that. What I did was I Googled first episode of Doctor Who on YouTube and I watched the first 15 minutes, the first clip which was up on YouTube, first 15 minutes, and then I set it 10 minutes before that. And that's how I did it.
So the story is called A Big Hand for the Doctor. And we'll actually be talking to Margaret Atwood later about her unnerving poem, A Girl With No Hands.
Yes.
But in your story, you depict the Doctor as having had his hands cut off in search of new ones. So where did you get the idea?
It's like A Big Hand for the Doctor. His hand is slightly too big. So I always... It's like the whole Artemis Fowl series was based on the bad pun or the acronym LEP Recon, Leprechaun. And this is based on a big hand, usually meaning a round
of applause.
In this case, it means his hand, he's looking for a hand and the hand is slightly too big. So for some reason, when someone said the Doctor, in my mind, a big hand for the Doctor came from somewhere. It might be from an old Oscar Wilde player or something. And I thought, well, what if he had a hand that was slightly too big? And then I reverse engineered this story where he had to get a hand cloned and it was slightly too big for him, and that's where it came from. And then also I wanted somehow to, I liked the idea that it would cross-pollinate with Peter Pan. So I thought, if you were, how could J.M. Barrie come up with a story for Peter Pan by watching a Doctor Who adventure? And so it took a little bit of doing, but I kind of interlaced those two stories.
For anyone who hasn't read or heard the story, let's hear a bit from that now.
Okay, I'll read you a little bit. And in this short little excerpt, the Doctor is facing down what these creatures that are called soul pirates that are sucking the souls from children who sleep in Victorian London. So these children think they're being sucked off to Never Never Land, but actually their essence has been stolen. So it's not as cheery as J.M. Barrie thought it was going to be. The orange antigrav beam pulsed, scorching a cylinder through the London fog. Silhouettes of brainwashed abductees floating in its depths, dreamily certain that they were flying to their own tailor-made heavens. Jolly adventures, trees to climb, heroes all. How long would that fantasy sustain them before the reality of the soul pirate's ship manifested? The Doctor advanced cautiously, picking his way along the slick ridge, keeping his cane extended all the while. As soon as he stepped out from behind the chimney, the full force of the elements battered him with sideswipes of wind and tacks of icy rain. He struggled to keep his balance on the treacherous slating, and each time a loose tile slipped from its moorings and smashed on the cobbles below, the Doctor remembered the danger he was in.
Oh, I'm really intrigued by what you said earlier about the fact that you hadn't seen the TV show, so your reference points were the books. But when you were writing this e-short, did you think in your head that this has to be something very visual because, you know, they might make an episode out of it down the road?
I think that is the way I write. I write visually, and I think it's because as a younger writer, I wanted to be a graphic artist, a comic book artist, and that I had set my sights on that. And for many, many years, that is what I wrote. Myself at home, I wrote comic books. I put comic books together. I stapled them and I tried to sell them on the street. It wasn't a very good venture because there would be about £5 worth of materials in every comic book, which I would then sell for 2 pence.
It strikes me though that the Artemis Fowl books would work very well as graphic novels.
Well, they do. The first three are out already, and I'm working with an amazing artist. So he has fulfilled my ambition for me by making them into these wonderful and graphic novels.
Was it difficult to leave Artemis behind after so many books? But then, of course, we have the forthcoming movie adaptation. So you get to return in some way, I guess. You get to see him again.
It wasn't difficult to leave the writing behind. I mean, there's a lot of things associated with the writing that are difficult. Because I had been working on these books for, I suppose, 15 years in all, and I'm a grown man, and thinking about leprechauns for that long, you have to let it go. And I was really happy to say, okay, that's enough, Little Green Men. It's time to talk about grown-up stuff like time travel.
but you do, I mean, with those books, you've managed to take something that is quite fairy tale-like, but you've made it modern and you've made it technological. You've sort of twisted that fairy world in a way.
Twisting fairy worlds has always been one of my ambitions. And I like genre fiction, whether it's crime fiction or fantasy fiction or sci-fi. I think there's not much point going into it if you're not going to give it a twist. And with the Artemis fiction, which I think was fantasy really, the twist was that it would be technological and kind of gritty. And so people go into it thinking, well, I'm going to get the usual, it's going to be a kid on a quest. But they go, oh, hold on, these fairies aren't normal. There's no wishes. They have machines. It's technological. And that was the twist. And I think that's what hooked people into it. But it's done now. And the arc of that story, if you like, was that Artemis is a bad guy. He becomes a good guy. And once he becomes a good guy, if you keep going, you're milking it. And the stories then become watered down or milked down, whichever. So it's done and it's time to move on. And I do miss having the legions of fans, Artemis fans. But, you know, I'm just going to have to build that up again, hopefully.
Thanks, Sohan Colfer. A Big Hand for the Doctor is available on Amazon and on the iBookstore. Well, we're staying with fairy tales, retellings and actual hands here on The Book Show. The motif appears in Grimm's fairy tale and is re-explored by Margaret Atwood in her poem Girl Without Hands. In the poem, the devil tricks a father into promising him his daughter, and her father cuts off her hands. Margaret Atwood read from this poem for The Book Show.
Then there's the girl in the white dress, meaning purity, or the failure to be any color. She has no hands, it's true. The scream that happened to the air when they were taken off surrounds her now like an aureole of hot sand, of no sound. Everything has bled out of her. Only a girl like this can know what's happened to you. If she were here, she would reach out her arms towards you now and touch you with her absent hands, and you would feel nothing, but you would be touched all the same.
And that was Margaret Atwood reading from Girl Without Hands. Margaret, in A Handmaid's Tale, and most recently in your Oryx and Craig trilogy, your work has been set in dystopian worlds, but it's speculative fiction, and yet you clearly draw on fairy tale, and particularly Grimm's fairy tales, in your work. How much of an impact did they have on you as a younger reader when you read them first?
Well, they are one of the wellsprings of story, not just Grimm's, but they're a bit like dress patterns, aren't they? So those ones, the Greek mythology and the Bible, are the three huge sources of story for Western literature. These are foundational stories, if you like. And the Grimm's ones, my parents sent away for an edition of them, which they did not realize would be unexpurgated. And they had all of them in, and in every red-hot eyeball and, you know, corpse coming down the chimney. And I think they thought this would be too frightening for their children, but in fact it was not.
And was it important for you to read those adult versions, and how much do they differ, apart from the censored elements, up to the children's ones?
Well, I think there was a movement in the 50s, which was too late for me, which Disney got hold of them and changed the endings quite a bit and removed all of the ones that were really gruesome. And you got a lot of pink dresses and sparkly things and wands and, you know, wings on the fairies and what have you. But that was not anything that really interested me very much.
In fairy tales, the children's versions at least, I guess, there are generally reasonably clear morals, and the main characters in your novels are not clear-cut, they're not wholly bad, they're not wholly good. Does this make them more believable?
Well, let us talk about those clear morals.
Let's.
Because often they're a lot less clear than you might think. I was talking with Neil Gaiman recently, and he was talking about how fairy tales had just scared him quite thoroughly when he was a child, beginning with Hansel and Gretel. So the parents leave their kids in the forest. Oh, just a minute now. My parents are going to abandon me. Hang on here. And then the two children find this old woman living in a gingerbread house. Well, that sounds quite nice. I like gingerbread. And they go inside. Oh, she's going to fatten them up and then cook them and eat them. Hang on a minute. and then they trick her and they murder her. And then these two murderous children go back and rejoin their parents who have abandoned them in the first place. And that's a happy ending?
It's cheery.
So there is in fact a lot of ambiguity inherent in fairy tales. I think one of the things that the children's Disneyfied versions did was clean them up and usually give you only the ones in which the girls are rather passive princesses.
Do you find that fairy tales are a useful way to retell stories for contemporary readers?
Let us just say something about stories in general. If you look at what children do before the age of four or so, you're probably looking at the human comes with toolkit. So they pick up language just like little sponges. You don't have to sit them down and teach them language. They will just absorb it. they understand narrative around the age of one. You know, they get it that something happens on this page and then something else happens and then something else happens, which is narrative. Music seems to be a come with, and rhythm, dancing up and down. Little babies will do that just spontaneously. So everything we do before that age is probably something that's inherent, and story is one of those things. Narrative seems to be built in. Think of what an advantage that would be if you were a social being before the arrival of agriculture, say, and you wanted to tell the younger members in your society, don't go swimming there, you know, crocodiles. On the other hand, here's this mushroom is good, that mushroom is bad. With story, people did not have to learn these things individually for themselves, which meant they had a much better chance of surviving. So I think we've always used stories for both instruction and delight.
You mentioned instruction there, and speculative and science fiction are very useful for reflecting on our own politics, aren't they?
I knew Judith Merrill, who was a practitioner in the 50s, and she said, well, we were using science fiction to talk about McCarthyism in ways that wouldn't get us arrested. And it has been a form that has been used in countries under political pressure to talk about things that were bothering them.
Throughout your work, and I think the whole canon of speculative fiction, there's always the aim for the perfect society, isn't there?
So it is a way of talking about forms of government, and usually ones that you don't want, although in the 19th century it was prevailingly ones that you did want. It was the age of utopias. People thought they really might happen. We'd made such improvements, such technological improvements, discoveries of diseases, etc. Why shouldn't mankind become perfected? Well, First World War put paid to that one, backed up by the Second World War even more so. And it just became hard to talk about utopia because Soviet Socialist Union came in as a utopia, and so did Hitler's Germany, and so did Mao's China. So before making everything perfect, there always seems to be this problem. We have to get rid of these people. And that goes on and on and on, and the perfect future never arrives.
Thanks to Margaret Atwood, whose latest book, Mad Adam, the final book in her Oryx and Craig trilogy, is published by Bloomsbury. Now, the trilogy also includes The Year of the Flood, and a new exhibition celebrating the book takes place in the aptly named Flood Gallery in Dublin. So we Cummins went along to check it out.
Year of the Flood is a multimedia exhibition curated by Michelle Horrigan.
The Year of the Flood is set in the not-too-distant future where a major catastrophe has occurred, and it focuses on a very small group of survivors that have managed to make their way through this catastrophe.
This group, God's Gardeners, are concerned with the environment and humanity's mistreatment of it.
My name's Martin Grevy, and I'm a painter.
So what we're looking at here is we have kind of, in a way, a country scene. It's very vivid colours, though. We have evergreen trees, but they're red and yellow and quite bright colours. In the middle of the picture, we have a bog pool, and through it there is a pipe sticking right up.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's kind of incongruous, isn't it? Because we have something quite industrial stuck into a landscape.
Yeah, I think it's also where I live now as well. I always grew up in a city. I've lived the last 8 years in North Kildare. So it has this kind of industrial, semi-industrial landscape where there's not much but bog and gravel pits and things like that and quarries. So you have this kind of not rustic, but you have this landscape and then this kind of industrial crud that sort of coats everything. Trucks going up and down small bog roads with lots of industrial-looking waste or waste going into landfills. And I suppose that just seeps into your work.
God's Gardeners in the Year of the Flood have their own festivals and saints. This exhibition features a sculpture by Tom Fitzgerald named A Saint for Margaret Atwood.
The head is covered with newspaper, and the newspaper is actually the very last edition of the News of the World. So I think it's a very interesting alignment because in the Year of the Flood, there's a lot of talk about not writing, particularly with God's Gardeners, not writing down your ideas or your words, that everything is kind of passed on in a sort of social collective consciousness rather than it being a written word, because it was dangerous to write things down.
As to whether Atwood's world already exists is the theme explored in Mike Cooter's work.
My interest is in the narrative form of speculative futures. So science-based theory that's attempting to kind of work out what the relationships of different speculative futures are to one another.
So I'm looking here and we have a frame. It's a double-sided frame, so it's glass. You can see it from both sides, and you have, and on it there's written an equation. To me it's double Dutch. What does it say?
So what it is a graphic representation of these kind of different probabilistic states. Each of these states exists in a parallel universe. And in this interpretation, there's this relationship whereby they all exist and they all play out. And so Atwood's speculative future would be, because it's possible, it would be played out.
Both writers and artists are also very involved in sort of recreating a new world for people, or offering another alternative to a contemporary world that we live in. And this is something that writers do with their words, but artists do it very visually. So as you look around the space here today with the seven artists and the seven very different art practices that are in the space, you can see that each of them are actually literally creating their own dimension or creating their own space for you to kind of interpret.
That was Zoe Cummins at the Year of the Flood exhibition in the Flood Gallery in Dublin's James Joyce Street. The exhibition, if you'd like to see it, runs until December 7th. Now, we've been talking tonight about retelling and reimagining stories, but for some it isn't enough to just rework a theme. It becomes more critical than that, because some stories actually need to be saved. Save the Story is a library of 10 beautifully illustrated books. The Brainchild of Alessandro Barrico. He invited such writers as Ali Smith and Dave Eggers to rework stories like Antigone and Captain Nemo. The aim? To save great stories from oblivion by retelling them for a new, younger generation. One of those tales is Gulliver, originally by Dublin essayist Jonathan Swift, reimagined here on his travels by writer Jonathan Coe.
Gulliver did his best to explain things to him. He explained that in the country he came from, all of the people were shaped like yahoos and walked upright on their back legs. But they were different in every other way. They were clever and civilized. They spoke to each other in lots of different languages. They wrote books and poems, had a genius for mathematics and science, were brilliant at inventing things, and they didn't fight each other all the time. As soon as he said this, however, Gulliver realized that it was not strictly true. Of course, human beings did have fights, terrible fights, but they weren't called fights, they were called wars. And since the Houyhnhnms didn't have a word for war in their language, Gulliver had to explain what that was.
And that was Nick McGinley reading from Gulliver by Jonathan Coe. Jonathan Coe is, of course, best known for his novels The Rotter's Club and What a Carve-Up, but Gulliver is his first experience of writing for children. Jonathan joins me now from London. Can I ask, how did you go about retelling what is essentially political satire to children?
Well, you know, my task in abridging it, really, for the Save the Story series was to pare Gulliver's Travels down to its essence. And I noticed that a lot of the satire in the first half of the book in particular was very specific to its time. That, you know, a lot of the episodes in the book are allusions to particular episodes in Swift's life or, you know, historical disputes that he'd been involved in and so on. I took a lot of those out and concentrated more on the kind of moral questions raised in the third and the fourth book in particular, where, you know, Swift is basically asking us, what is a human being? What does it mean to be human? Are we reasonable creatures, rational creatures, or are we governed only by our emotions and our passions? So he invented these two species, the Yahoos and the Houyhnhnms, the kind of the animalistic ape-like creatures and the sublimely calm and rational horses. And he positioned Gulliver somewhere in between them and said, okay, the reader has to choose which one are we more like. And it's a very uncomfortable question to ask, because both both creatures actually have their appealing side and their darker side.
For children, this is complex stuff. It's tied up in a rattling reed, but, you know, the end of Gulliver is very bleak. He essentially gives up and goes to live in the stable with the horses. Do you think that moral message might be just a little bit too pessimistic for children?
You know, I think if you look at the children's literature of today, when I look at the books that my daughters are reading, for instance, in their early teens, books like The Hunger Games, these are extremely dark and challenging and bleak stories in some ways. Dystopian fiction has become a staple of children's and teenage reading at the moment. And no, I think young readers can handle a lot more than we maybe give them credit for if the story is well told and simply told. I think that was the main difficulty I'd had as a young reader of Gulliver's Travels, that no attempt really had been made to simplify or make more accessible Swift's language, which of course to an adult reader is absolutely beautiful. He's one of the great prose writers in English. But for a child of 8 or 9, I think his diction, his vocabulary, his grammar, it's kind of challenging.
Why do you think that darkness appeals to young readers? Whether you go back to, you know, the fairy tale of Hansel and Gretel, which is very bleak, but, you know, young children like it and almost laugh at it, or you take John Green's mm-hmm. books where he deals with things like cancer. Why gravitate towards the darkness?
I think coming to terms with the fact that the world is not a perfect place is a very, very challenging process in a child's development. And any ways we can find to make that process easier, more comfortable, is to be encouraged, I think. And, you know, no great work of literature presents its readers with a kind of utopian version of what human life is like. Even comic fiction, on some level, accentuates and registers the dark side of human experience. And, you know, children's literature is, in many ways, is no different, I think.
And thanks so much to Jonathan Coe. Gulliver and the other 9 books in the Save the Story series are published by Pushkin Children's Books. And that's all we have time for tonight. But if you'd like to find out about any of the books that we've discussed or mentioned tonight, you can find The Book Show on rte.ie. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at BookshowRTE. My thanks to Regan Hutchins for his contribution. The Book Show was produced by Zoe Cummins. And we leave you this evening with a footnote.
By the time of her recent death, aged 94, Doris Lessing had some baubles behind her, scooping many of the top literary prizes, receiving the Nobel Prize for Literature, as well as turning down a damehood along the way. The author of The Grass is Singing and The Golden Notebook was not one to rest on her laurels, and in 1982, attempting to escape her fame and draw attention to the challenges facing young, unknown writers in getting published, she wrote a novel under a pseudonym, Jane Summers. She proved her point. An agent sent the manuscript, The Diary of a Good Neighbour, to her own publishers, Jonathan Cape, and, after some consideration, they rejected it.